For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Now, tonight we are in Luke chapter 21. This is the last week of Christ's life, and you can just see everything coming into focus as his teaching about himself is increasingly clear about who he is and what he's come to do, the cost of what does it mean to follow him, and very importantly, just the divide that exists between a religious establishment that is rooted in its own self-serving self-righteousness and God's Messiah that has come to deal with the central problem that separates human beings from God, namely our guilt and our alienation before him. So these things are coming together, and in that context, Jesus begins this little section that is recorded here in Luke 21, but also in Mark 13 and Matthew 24. All three of these are what are sometimes called the synoptic gospels. They are very much related in terms of their literary dependence on each other and the information that they cover. And so they're talking about what is referred to as the Olivet Discourse, which is Jesus's primary teaching on the end of human history. And this is something that I think cultivates a lot of interest. Unfortunately, a lot of speculation as well. We want to walk through the main lines of the thought here this evening and see what it means for us in terms of application. Let's take a look. It says, chapter 21, verse 5, while some were talking about the temple, that's the temple in Jerusalem, the temple that Herod built, this magnificent, enormous temple that Herod erected both as sort of a monument to himself, his ego, but also to satisfy the Jewish people under his reign. He built this thing. It's a remarkable, it's one of the great wonders of the ancient world architecturally. And it says that while some were talking about this temple, that it was adorned with beautiful stones and votive gifts, Jesus said, "As for these things, you're looking at the days will come when there will not be left one stone upon another, which will not be torn down." And so they question him, saying, "Teacher, when will these things happen? And what will be the sign that these things are about to happen?" And so here, Jesus is really echoing something that he has just said a couple of days before that we saw in Luke 19 in the so-called triumphal entry when Jesus entered into Jerusalem. Remember that a few weeks back when we were studying that? And he comes in on this baby donkey in this kind of weird, ironic scene of the conquering king coming in with such humility. And as he enters the city and the Pharisees tell him, "Hey, your disciples are telling us that you're the one that is expected. You're the Messiah. Tell them to shut up." And Jesus says, "Oh, no, this is the moment they're recognizing publicly for the first time who I am." And then he begins to lament and weep over the city. And he says, "Only if you only knew the time of your visitation, but it's been hidden from you. And for this reason, this magnificent city is to be destroyed and the temple with it." So Jesus goes right back to that same thing. Here again, as the disciples, as we're told in Mark 13, make this observation about the wonder of the temple, Jesus says, "You all enjoy it now because it's not going to be there for long." And then they ask this question as a follow-up. These are the questions, of course, that we want to know. It's amazing to think that such a magnificent and extraordinary building would be reduced to rubble. But then they say, "Well, when is it going to happen? We'd like to know. And very importantly, what are the signs that are going to occur that alert us to this impending event?" And so this then brings us into a study of the Bible's view of history. And it's really super important, actually, that we understand this broader framework of how God views the history of the universe. There's a beginning and an end. In Matthew's account of this exact same conversation, Matthew adds, not only did the disciples say, when will these things happen, and what about the signs that indicate that? He includes as well this phrase, and the end of the age. In other words, when will the end of the age happen? And that's implicit in what Luke says, but Matthew makes it explicit. The end of the age. The idea that the Bible begins with this declaration in the beginning, right? There's a start. It hasn't always been. God spoke the universe into being. In a moment in time, the universe is finite. It has not always been. Not only does the Bible declare this in a very matter-of-fact way, even science describes the same phenomenon, the so-called Big Bang. We can actually date the age of the universe in which we live. And it has a beginning. But unlike all religious and philosophical writings, both in antiquity and today, up to today, who view human history as essentially pointless, as going nowhere, human life also pointless in reference to no thing that gives us any kind of ultimate significance or transcendent significance. In the world outside the Bible, you have basically a cyclical concept that just as the seasons change from year to year, and they don't seem to be going anywhere, it's just a repetition of the same thing, so too is history, just repeating the same patterns, the same things over and over, for no apparent reason, to no end, to serve no purpose at all. And so the real important question of what makes my life matter is an unanswerable question, because your life is just as pointless as the unfolding of human history itself. And the Bible steps in its ancient context and speaks and continues to speak today that no, that conception is not right, that we are not here just by some quirk of biological accident for no purpose whatsoever, just to go on in some pointless number of years and then to go into extinction, but that there is a plan and design to human history, that God created the universe to serve good ends, to reflect who He is, His goodness, and His intent to create beings in His image that share in His dignity and value, who are capable of entering into permanent love relationship, both with one another and with Him, and with the freedom to make that choice to either enter in or not. But there's a purpose and a design for the thing. And that's why the Bible begins in Genesis chapter 1 and ends in Revelation 21 with essentially the same sort of scene in mind of God looking over His people in the environment that He created for them to enjoy life and unfettered access to Him. That is a linear view of history. God has a plan to take broken people, sinful people, people who are far from Him, and bring them into a relationship with Him through Jesus Christ. That God, through Christ, atones, or He pays for the separation that we have between ourselves and a holy God by virtue of our rebellion against Him. The chasm that separates us is just simply too great. But God has provided that way in Christ. So, from the Bible's point of view, the Bible is a total story with a beginning and a meaningful sequence of events that brings us to this end point. And so, that's pretty significant. There is, just as it's impossible to think of any kind of meaningful way to describe moral concepts like good or bad or justice or anything like that, apart from some real, true, objective, and universal standard to which those ideas relate, which give them meaning more than just I feel this way or I like that or I don't. So too, when we think about my life, why do I matter? Why am I here? What difference does it make what I do with my life? This gets an answer in relation to the bigger question, is there any purpose for the human race at all? And the Bible says, you bet there is, because God is in the mix. History is going someplace. Where is it going? And how does it get there? That's what we want to explore here tonight. Let's take a closer look. Jesus makes it clear that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. And of course, Jerusalem was destroyed, just as Jesus said that it would. And why is this important? It's important because prophecy, the ability to predict future events, is really the hallmark of the Bible's means of self-authentication. In other words, we ask this question, why should I believe what this religious document teaches? I mean, every religion's got their sacred text, right? And they all say different kinds of things, and they all certainly contradict one another in important ways. They can't all be right. So how do we know which one is right? Well, the Bible's answer for that is prophecy. That God, who knows the future, is able to speak these events into the pages of human history through his word before they happen, as a way for people then to have a concrete foundation upon which to say, here is information that could not have been known otherwise, predicted specifically well before the event takes place. Well, what's your explanation? See, and this is part of the argument that Jesus gives to reasonable people to form their faith around true information, real data that satisfies us intellectually. We saw that a few weeks ago when we explored Daniel's 70 weeks or 70 Sabbaths prophecy. Remember that? That predicted the very year that we're describing here where Jesus comes into Jerusalem and announces that he is that long-awaited messianic king. That's pretty extraordinary, right down to the very year. Well, Jesus also establishes his ability to predict what's going to happen at the end of human history, first by predicting this event that is in the near-term future and in the lifespan of most of the people who will hear it, namely that this temple, this city as well, is going to be destroyed. And that fits then into this broader prophetic timeline that I want to express to you here, because we're going to cover a lot of material, and I just think it's easy to get lost in the sauce. And so the big picture would be that we understand Jesus' ministry as between about 30 and 33 AD. And that in the spring of 33 AD, Jesus is executed Roman style on a cross. We know that this is true. We are not left to wonder about it. We don't just get this information from the pages of the Bible. We can read it in the Roman historian Tacitus, in the Jewish historian Josephus, and in other writings that were datable to this first century, and they knew that these events occurred. That's a hard fact. Then Jesus predicts this event that we're reading right here, the destruction of the temple and of the city, which does in fact occur in 70 AD. The Roman general Titus, in quelling yet another uprising of these cantankerous Jewish people, leads his army into the city to deal with this problem once and for all, and desecrates the temple and destroys it. Then there is a window of time, which we'll see in a few minutes, Jesus calls in verse 24 of this passage, the time of the Gentiles. And this is a time where Israel is no longer existing as a real political entity, as a nation. And it is the time where God allows the free exercise of the nations to rule the world as they see fit, in their way and in their terms. Not having abandoned his plan, but giving humanity time to play out the real implications of what is true at the core of human nature. And that he's going to bring this time of the Gentiles into resolution. First, by moving in history to regather the nation of Israel. In the parallel passage in Mark chapter 13, verse 27, Jesus says that he is going to, that God will regather the nations to their land from the four corners of the earth to which they have been spread out. This is a citation from the Old Testament prophet Isaiah chapter 11, verse 12. Then there is a period which is a great tribulation, just 7 years prior to the return, triumphal return of Christ, the great tribulation where the whole of human history, the whole of human animosity toward God reaches its zenith, and where God then himself intervenes in history and returns to set up his rule on the earth. That is the biblical picture of how human history unfolds. This is rooted not only in the teaching of Jesus, but it is also utterly available to us as we study the Old Testament itself. And so in this way, the Old and New Testament are very much united in their picture of how does this story end up. So let's just break down the parts of it that relate to Jesus' Olivet Discourse. The end times, that's what this is. Envisioning that conclusion, that crescendo of human history. And Jesus goes on and he says, see to it that no one mislead you. See that you're not misled. For many will come in my name and they'll say, I'm he. And the time is near. And he says, do not follow them. When you hear of wars and disturbances, do not be terrified, for these must take place first, but the end does not follow immediately. Then he continued, nation will rise up against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and there will be great earthquakes and in various places famines. There will be terrors and signs in the heavens. And so Jesus begins his description of what is to come with a warning. A very important warning. A warning that is way too often not heeded. What does he say? He says, there are going to be people who come in my name. And they say, they're going to say, I'm the Messiah. And the time of the end is near. Wow, you just have to pick up the newspaper periodically to read the story of these end of the world cults who are calling people to run out into the wilderness and to encamp and wait for the return of Christ. And I'm at that age where when I was starting to actually think consciously as a human being about the world around me, in the late 60s, cults of all kinds were coming together, declaring new messiahs, Hindu messiahs, and pseudo-Christian messiahs, and all kinds of messiahs, and predictions of the end of the world. And it's almost comical to look back and realize so many of the cults that make up the world today are of this sort, of these self-appointed messiahs who are calling people to the end of the world. Didn't work out. It never could work out, because Jesus says so clearly in the parallel in Matthew 24, verse 36, he says, about that day, no one knows. See that? No one knows. Not even the angels in heaven or the Son, but only the Father. So repeat after me. No one knows. Someone tells you, I know, I've figured it out. I got this system. I've crunched some numbers. I got a spreadsheet. It's going to be like, I don't know, May 14th, 2017. What do you say to him? No one knows. That's exactly, see, you guys are good. You're with it. You are teachable. It's important. Nobody knows, not even the Son. But what we do know is an answer to the question that the disciples asked, which is about the character of the day, the signs of his coming, and what that would be like. And so he says, when you hear of wars, disturbances, don't be terrified, for these things must take place first. But the end does not follow immediately. What is he referring to here? He's referring to what in Matthew he describes as birth pangs. It's the idea that there are events that occur. He says, all of these things are merely the beginnings of birth pangs. What does it mean? A birth pang relates to things that occur, certainly through late term pregnancy, Morgan, but intensify, she's having a baby on Thursday, but intensify as history unwinds. So like when a woman goes into labor, you know, you remember it's like, I feel something kind of funny. And then it gets funnier and more frequent and less funny. And that's how it works. And Jesus, kind of playing into this super common observation, says that's the way history works as well. That there are things that have sort of always been there, but which are going to intensify significantly as history unwinds and prepares the one who is astute and watching for the return of God's Messiah. What are those signs? He says nation will rise up against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There's war. And man, if there is anything like a comprehensive history of the human race, chapter one is war, followed by chapter two, which is another war, followed by chapter three, yet another war. And that's just kind of how, you know, history is shaped, right? But Jesus says that while these things, you know, are always in play, they are going to intensify like labor pains as the arrival of God's Messiah is increasingly at hand. And so we learn from Revelation 9, verse 16, for instance, about the armies of the east gathering for battle. It says, this is remarkable. You need to think about this. The number of the armies of the horsemen was 200 million. John says, after shaking his head and what? He says, I heard the number. Why is this so astounding? Well, because in the first century, there were barely 200 million people in existence. And now, looking at and gazing toward the end and receiving visions from God on the island of Patmos, John, here's the scenario. And he is told that there is an army gathering for battle from the east, and they will migrate to the Middle East. And the number of their combatants is 200 million. That would be a very large scale of war. We're told in Matthew 24, the parallel to Luke 21, unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. So now we're talking about not only the scale of war that was unimaginable in the first century, and really unimaginable in any century until the 20th, and now the 21st century, we're also talking about a lethality of war. You know, you can throw a lot of sticks and stones and shoot a lot of spears and arrows and create a lot of damage, but you're not going to arrive at a place where, unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. No, that's the treat of living in the modern age. And anyone who's lived in the shadow of thermonuclear warfare knows exactly what the description given to battle in Revelation 9 is, and 8 as well, where a third of the earth is scorched, and a third of its streams are made toxic, and a third of all life is destroyed. How could that occur outside of the conventions of modern warfare? And so that's sort of a remarkable picture that comes from a very ancient source. Birth pangs. Famine, he says. And here, there's always been famine, no question about it. But now, as the population increases, as I said a minute ago, the population of the ancient world at the time of Christ was scarcely more than 200 million people. Today we have how many? 7 billion? 7 billion? And so you see the escalation of the implications of a year, 2 year, three of poor harvests, drought, other kinds of conditions that repeatedly come up. There's no real change in that. But now the implications are so much greater for masses of population, masses of humanity. And Jesus is simply declaring that the Green Revolution is not going to get the job done. It doesn't mean we shouldn't try. We'll be clear about that. We need to care about people who are at risk and who are vulnerable. But at the end of the day, the need, he says, is going to far exceed the capability. Natural phenomena. Earthquakes. He says, tears and signs from heaven, which is unclear exactly what does that mean. We know what earthquakes mean. And he's saying that as the end draws near, these earthquakes have a lethality about them, an impact about them that is greater than in the past. I will never forget in the spring of 2010, driving through the streets of Port-au-Prince. Well, they weren't really streets at that point. They're more rubble piles. And just looking at a city and Ligon, just outside of it, where 90% of the buildings were completely eliminated by earthquake. And 1.2 million people had been reduced to living in tents. I'm like, wow. That took a matter of seconds for 300,000 people to lose their life. And that's a window, that's a picture of the kind of phenomena that Jesus says is going to anticipate his return. So we move on. Verse 12, he says, but for all these things, they will lay their hands on you and they will persecute you, delivering you to the synagogues and prisons, bringing you before kings and governors for my name's sake. And this will lead to an opportunity for you to give your testimony. So make up your minds not to prepare beforehand to defend yourselves, for I will give you utterance and wisdom, which none of your opponents will be able to resist or refute. So this is the other part of it, that there's a spiritual change as well, that those who are taking their stand with God are going to be opposed, that there is a spiritual, social climate. You know, we think in our culture, if you're spiritual, that's good, no matter what that is. We're beginning to see the fringes in our own day of religious extremism and what that means, not only in terms of warfare, but in terms of the persecution of Christian and other religious minorities that live in their midst today. That's going to intensify, and it's going to be more specific in terms of believers in Jesus Christ. We note in Matthew 24, the same context where he's talking about the reaction of people to believers in him, he says, because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold. Yeah. What does that represent? It represents a loss of community, a loss of conscience, a loss of the integrity of family where we learn bonds that connect people together, that give us a sense of identity and what is appropriate and how people should be treated and so forth. And so we're looking at the utter breakdown of society and of human relationships as people's love will grow cold as they pursue just their own self-interest, their own pleasures, things like this, and at the expense of Christians who probably in context are presenting a different way of life and who are in the way for that reason and who are an embarrassment perhaps and who bring our attention to a God who cares about not just the desires of self, but the concerns of justice of truth and so forth. And Jesus says, it's interesting, he says, you know, don't worry, you're going to be persecuted, but don't worry about it. Because why? Because there's this opportunity that comes with that to give a testimony, to tell your story about what God has done in your life. And so you have this really weird kind of confluence of two things. One, significant hostility against God, and on the other hand, deeper and deeper need for God, you know? People, as they veer further and further out of God's orbit and are, you know, putting up the hand and the fist to God and are not interested in the things of God, they're free to do that, but they're not free with respect to the consequence of living this way, because it's still God's world that we live in. And so the defiant against God end up just breaking themselves on the anvil of their own desires. I used to be like that. I suspect most of us, many of us here tonight, I know exactly what we're describing here. To chart that course and to say, I'm going to do life my way, on my terms. I don't care if there's a God or not. I'm going to do it my way. And then you come to that place where, you know, life catches up. And pretty soon you're pretty burned out. And the things that you thought would bring you so much satisfaction are just, they're just not that way anymore. And you wonder, you know, what's the point of it? What's the point of this thing? There's got to be a better way. There's got to be another way. And so you're stuck with this defiance on the one hand and this incredible need on the other. And Jesus says, just speak the truth. Let people know what I've done for them. Let them know what it's meant in your life. And that will speak in a deep way right in there to the heart. And that's why he connects the persecution with the church in Matthew 24 with the worldwide spread of the good news about Jesus Christ. That's how it works. In the early church, they had an expression, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. Tertullian said that. And it's just the idea that as people would stand up and say, you know, this is what, I'm not going to worship a man who pretends to be God. I'm going to worship the one and only God. And if that means I pay the price with my life, so be it. And as these people stood in there and remained loyal to Christ, and they continued to love and care about the broken people around them, even when their pagan neighbors would not, and they would pay the price of this with their life, people began to take notice and say, what is it about them that enables them, that gives them both the courage and the integrity to really put their money where their mouth is? There must be something to this. And people began to explore. And that is really, in a significant way, how the early church became a movement of 70 fearful people in an upper room to about a million by the end of the first century. Jesus is really describing that here. He goes on, he says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is near. People will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And so that brings us back to where we were talking about. Jesus is predicting the collapse of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple, and this time of Gentile rule over God's people and in a freer way over the earth. He talks about the captivity into all the nations. That's right, because the Jews were expelled from Jerusalem, and then in 130 AD, after another revolt, they were expelled from Palestine as well. And so they were just sent all over the inhabited world. And that is exactly what God knew was going to occur. In Daniel chapter 9, verse 26. Fascinating. The time between the Messiah's first and second coming is described so clearly in a passage that we looked at some a couple weeks ago. He said, after the 62 weeks or Sabbath years, the Messiah will be cut off. That's an unmistakable figure of speech. It means that the Messiah will be killed. We ask this question, does the Old Testament really teach that the Messiah would come and die? How much clearer could it be? He's cut off. He has nothing. And then it says the people of the prince to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. And so right there we have that scenario. Just as Jesus predicted. He comes in, announces the fulfillment of this great prophecy of the Messiah's coming. He's killed. He's resurrected from the dead. And then the city and its sanctuary are destroyed. Just as Jesus said. And the people are dispersed. Captive, it says, to all the nations. But we have this hope as well. That that's not the end of the story, because God said something more powerful than the nations themselves. All of the power of Rome came to destroy the Jewish state, as it did all the other ethnic peoples that it ruled. And so all of Israel's neighbors are erased from history. Where are the Moabites? And the Edomites, and all of these other ethnic peoples, they don't exist. But God preserved, even in another kind of exile, his people for the end time. When human history is playing out, and now it's time for God to begin moving and activating his plan, it begins with the regathering of the nation of Israel. Isaiah 11, verse 12, which is also cited in Mark chapter 13, the same parallel in Mark's gospel, he says, he will assemble the banished ones of Israel and will gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. And Mark, Jesus really echoing that, says he will gather together his chosen people from the four winds, from the farthest ends of the earth. Jesus is bringing his readers right back to Isaiah's prophecy. No, the destruction of the city is not the end of the story. The city will be rebuilt. The people will regather into their land. Well, that's an interesting sign, I'm going to say. Given that in May of 1948, Israel, after 1900 years, was reconstituted as a nation. They're back. What does that mean? It means that we see in the fulfillment of the promise, the pledge, 700 years ago, before the time of Christ, 700 years before the time of Christ, and in the mouth of Christ himself in the first century. Yes, the city will be destroyed and the people will be dispersed. But the time is coming where these people will be regathered. That's an amazing, amazing statement. And yet it is fulfilled. Fulfilled in the lifetime of even some people here tonight. Remarkable. And so we can feel some sense then that we are moving toward that in one very tangible, measurable criteria of the end of the age. When is that? Nobody knows. Good. But we're moving in that way. We have that very tangible evidence. He goes on, verse 25. We'll just wrap it up here. He says, there will be signs in the sun, the moon, the stars, the earth in dismay among the nations, in perplexity at the roaring of the seas and the waves. So he has this kind of like apocalyptic doomsday kind of imagery that he's using. People fainting from fear and the expectation of things which are coming upon the world. For the powers of heaven will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. When these things begin to happen, straighten up and lift your heads. Redemption is near. Wow. How come it has to end like this? I mean, I was hoping kind of it would end like we'd all sit down and say, okay, let's be grown-ups here. We got problems. Let's just work it out and be nice. No. Why? Because the reality is people are not that way. What's your view of human nature? If given just long enough, we'll figure it out, we'll grow up, we'll do the right thing, we'll find a way to just get along. Well, I would love to think that that was true, but it's not. That there's something really fundamentally broken, beyond repair, about humankind. No, we don't have the ability to fix the very problems that we have ourselves have created. That biblical history is a demonstration of the fact that if given just long enough, we should be able to prove to ourselves our utter ineptitude at dealing with these fundamental things. Yes, there are advances forward at various points. Absolutely. And so we can be thankful for the developments in modern medical science and things like that. But the problem is that the more we develop technologically, the more at risk we place ourselves. And this is going to come to roost, the Bible declares. Why? Not because technology is evil or that knowledge is bad. It's that there's something so broken about human beings living in a world with limited resources and with stuff that we want that we do not have, that we're going to take it if given the opportunity. From people who don't want to give it up. And that's the problem. We are really in a pickle as humanity. We are broken and cannot fix it. But there's a more important part of that, which is the personal thing, which is that you're broken. You're broken. That you don't have the resources to deal with the circumstances of your life that have been created by your own rebellion against God, your own violation of your own conscience, that you know God has called you to something real, something better. We're alienated. It's true that we can kind of give ourselves a picture of doing okay. You know, because why? Because we've got the resources to satisfy most of our wants and stuff like that. But the reality is we are alienated from God. That we are a part of the machinery of humanity, that when we look at the history books and we look at the newspaper today and we extrapolate into the future and we see there's a problem here, that problem is not just out there. It's the same problem that's in here. And Jesus says, here's what you need. Redemption. Redemption is a biblical term that means to buy out of, to atone for, or to pay for. It's the idea that we're in debt over our heads. We're upside down on our lives, not just our mortgages. We owe more to God than we can ever pay. And so what are we going to do with this? We can try to self-justify and say, hey, you know, I'm really not that bad. I don't really owe that much. Well, that's okay. You can say that. But that's not what God says. We have a difference of opinion here. I think his is going to carry the day. And yet, because he loves us, he does not want to consign us to the folly of our way and the results of separation from him, not just in this life, but forever. That he has taken upon himself the burden of our debt. That's what the cross of Christ was. The dying for your sins and mine. That's what redemption is, to buy us out of our bondage to our debt before God. What do you need? You need redemption. You need the grace of God. And the good news is that God offers you his grace. He's not asking you to meet him halfway or to do, you know, swear to be better or do whatever. He's just saying, will you humble yourself to realize that what's true of humanity is true of you, that you really are broken, that you really don't have the resources to reform yourself. And will you receive my forgiveness? Will you receive reconciliation with me? Will you receive my spirit that will regenerate you into a new person. And that's the change that he's come to offer. Not a better you, but a new you. That's what redemption brings. If that sounds good to you, I just urge you. We're going to be praying here in a few minutes. Just interact yourself personally with God. And just say, hey, I see this in myself. I want to be reconciled to you. I want to be forgiven. I'm just asking you on the basis of Christ and what he's done, will you apply that to me? Will you forgive me on the basis of what he did? That's all God cares about. A humble and contrite heart, David says in Psalm 51. That's what God seeks. So he says then to the rest of us, be on guard, so that your hearts will not be weighed down with dissipation and drunkenness and the worries of this life, and that the day will not come on you suddenly like a trap. Stay alert at the times, praying that you may have strength to escape all these things that are about to happen and to stand before the Son of Man. So that's pretty simple to see what he's calling us there. Be on guard. Live with the end in mind. That's what he's saying. The end is coming. Maybe it's in your lifetime. Maybe it's not. But it is coming. And there is an end time for us all, too, right? We may not be here to see Christ come back, but we're going to come face to face with him. We have a limited amount of time on this earth. And so he's just saying, be on your guards. The things that pull for your attention and stuff, the things in your heart, he says, that weigh you down, the worries of this life, it's real easy just to trivialize your existence just to satisfying basic physical urges and desires and minimizing worry and risk. Wow, what a pathetically diminished view that is of human life. And instead, he says, why don't you be all in for me? If we know where this is all going, look, why would you eagerly sign up and say, yes, I'll put pinstripes on the Titanic? That sounds like a great life's work. No, there's so much more to be invested in the people of God, to be contributing to a community that is molding and shaping the very face of eternity. That is significant. That's what matters. Everything else is second. And that's all I got to say. So we're done.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.